more days, until the expedition had gotten below the next falls, which were but 2 miles downstream, to give the captains an opportunity to bring about a peace between the warring nations. The next set of falls, called the Dalles, began with the Short Narrows, a quarter-mile-long stretch in which the river was constricted to a mere 45 yards in width. Clark was appalled by the horrid appearance of this agitated, gut-swelling water, boiling and whirling in every direction. The captains explored the banks. Agreeing that no portage for the heavy canoes was possible over the rocky ledges, they decided to send by land the men who could not swim, carrying the most valuable articles with them, while they and the swimmers ran the fall in the canoes, bringing the heavy and less valuable baggage with them. In selecting the items to be portaged, the captains showed their priorities. First of all, the journals, field notes, and other papers, including Jefferson's letter of credit to Lewis, which would become invaluable if they chanced to meet a trading ship at the mouth of the Columbia. Second, the rifles and ammunition. This was taking a chance. For the first time, the bulk of the party would be defenseless in the presence of Indians, but that risk was more acceptable than risking the rifles in the falls. Finally, the scientific instruments. By the standards of today's canoeists, this was a Class 5 rapid, meaning it could not be run even in a modern canoe specially designed for whitewater. The natives, expert canoeists themselves, did not believe Lewis and Clark could do it in their big, heavy dugouts. They gathered by the hundreds along the banks to watch the white men drown themselves and to be ready to help themselves to the abandoned equipment afterward. But to the astonishment of the Indians, the Americans made the run without incident. Below the Short Narrows was a relatively calm 3 mile stretch. Along the bank there was an Indian village of wooden houses, the first wooden homes the captains had seen since they left St. Charles 17 months earlier. There were stacks of dried pounded fish on scaffolds, at least 5 tons by the captain's estimate. The principal chief from the village below paid a visit, which, in Clark's words, afforded a favorable opportunity of bringing about a peace and good understanding between this chief and his people and the two chiefs, Twisted Hair and Tito Harsky, which we have the satisfaction to say we have accomplished, as we have every reason to believe, and that those two bands of nations are and will be on the most friendly terms with each other. That was wishful thinking, and how the captains could have been so sure of themselves and so satisfied is a mystery. Neither side could understand a word the other side said, and the sign language of the Plains Indians that Driard used was imperfectly understood by the Chinooks. The next river obstacle was the Long Narrows, where the river narrowed to 50 to 100 yards for some 3 miles. As at the Short Narrows, the captains decided to have the non-swimmers portage the most valuable items, while they ran the river in the canoes. Again, Indians gathered on the banks to await the inevitable disaster. Again, the canoes made the passage safely. Below the narrows, where the river widened, the party made camp on a high point of rocks. The captains chose the site because it formed a kind of fortification. Clark explained, "This situation we conceive well calculated for defense." They called it Fort Rock Camp, on the site of today's city named the Dalles, Washington. There they stayed for 3 days to make repairs to the canoes, dry the baggage, and do some hunting. Lewis took the opportunity to make some celestial observations for longitude and compass variation. They had a parting smoke with Twisted Hair and Tito Harsky. The local Indians were proving troublesome because of their proclivity for petty theft. Any object laid aside for a moment vanished. The captain's greatest concern became not the Indians' arrows, but the protection of our stores from theft. It got so bad that the men muttered they were well disposed to kill a few of them. On at least one occasion, the captains had to restrain the men. As Clark pointed out, "It is necessary at this time to treat those people very friendly and ingratiate ourselves with them to ensure us a kind and friendly reception on our return." On the night of October 26, 2 chiefs and 15 men crossed the river in a canoe, bringing presents of deer meat and cakes of bread made of roots. The captains gave medals to the chiefs, trinkets to the men. Private Crusade brought out his violin. York danced for the Indians, to their delight. The hunters had brought in 5 deer that day, so there was plenty of meat. One of the men gigged a steelhead trout, which he fried in some bear oil given him by one of the Indians. Clark pronounced it, "one of the most delicious fish I have ever tasted." The visiting chiefs spent the night. Altogether, it was a good start for U.S. Chinookan relations. As always, Lewis took a vocabulary of the Indians, although how he accomplished it without a translator is unclear. On October 30th, the party set out again to a point 2 miles above the last great drop, the Cascades of the Columbia, the great chute to Lewis and Clark, where it made camp in anticipation of a reconnaissance in the morning. Lewis took a party of 5 men to visit a nearby Indian town. Along the way, he shot unsuccessfully at a California condor, which he correctly judged to be the largest bird in North America. At the village, he got a friendly reception. The Indians gave him berries, nuts, and fish to eat. But, he told Clark, he could get nothing from them in the way of information because of the language barrier. The reconnaissance revealed a section of river some 4 miles long filled with rapids passing through a series of chutes and falls, the water passing with great velocity forming and boiling in a most horrible manner. But beyond the great chute, the river widened and had every appearance of being affected by the tide, which was great news. On November 1st to 2nd, the party made its way through this final barrier. At times, the men had to portage the canoes and the baggage. At other places, it was possible to run the canoes through, using elkskin ropes to lower them. The following day, moving downstream, the party came to Beacon Rock, the beginning of tidewater. The expedition had entered a much-changed world. The banks were covered with fir, spruce, ash, and alder, contrasting sharply with the treeless semi-desert country upstream. Migrating waterfowl were everywhere. Fog was frequent and often thick. Many days the party could not set out until afternoon. Indian villages dotted the banks. Indian visits were frequent. The natives made a poor impression on Lewis and his party, except as canoeists, where their superiority over the white men was obvious and duly acknowledged. Otherwise, they were judged to be low and ill-shaped, badly clad and illy made, petty thieves and objects of suspicion. James Ronda points out that one reason for the overwhelmingly negative view the captains and their men had of the Indians near the mouth of the river was that the natives were accustomed to hard bargaining with whites in the sea otter trade, and therefore expected to drive equally hard bargains with the hungry explorers. Clark's journal is full of complaints about the inflated prices charged for roots and fish. The captains did not look forward to wintering with or near these Indians. They recalled with nostalgia the winter with the Mandans. They would have gladly traded the rainy weather for the bitter cold of Fort Mandan, especially if they could also have the honest and friendly Mandans for their winter companions and buffalo to eat. But it was not to be, and they determined to make the best of their situation. Their immediate concern was getting to the ocean. Not until that was accomplished could they begin to decide where to spend the winter. On November 2nd, the expedition passed the mouth of Sandy River, which had been the highest point upriver reached by European or American explorers. Lieutenant William Broughton of George Vancouver's 1792 expedition had gone this far up the Columbia. The following day, it reached present Vancouver, Washington, and camped opposite the mouth of the Willamette River, although they did not know it since the mouth was hidden by an island and they were on the north bank. For the first time since April 1805, the expedition was in country previously explored and mapped by whites. Here, the maps from west and from east came together. The party camped on an island. Lewis borrowed a small canoe from local Indians and with 4 men took her to a lake on the island, where they enjoyed an after-dark hunt. The lake was teeming with swans, brants, geese, and ducks. Lewis's party killed 3 swans, 8 brants, and 5 ducks. On the night of November 4th, several canoe loads of Indians from the village upstream came down for a visit. They were colorful, with scarlet and blue blankets, sailors' jackets, shirts, and hats, and apparently friendly. But they also brought along a show of weaponry that included war axes, spears, bows at the ready, quivers of arrows at their sides, some muskets and pistols. It was a situation fraught with danger. 2 groups of armed young men from different cultures, unable to communicate with words, facing each other. The captains were up to the challenge. "Even though those fellows we found assuming and disagreeable," Clark wrote, We smoked with them and treated them with every attention and friendship. But the atmosphere changed when Clark discovered that one of those fellows had stole my pipe tomahawk, which they were smoking with. Though Clark searched every man in the Indians' canoes, he could not find his pipe. To add to the injury, while the search was being carried out, an Indian stole Driar's capote, a long blanket coat, hooded, made of heavy wool, long popular in the Canadian fur trade. More angry words, and another search. The capote was found, but not the pipe. The captain showed their contempt and outrage, or, as Clark so nicely put it, "We became much displeased with those fellows, which they discovered and moved off." At this time, the expedition was making better than 30 miles a day down the lower Columbia. On November 5th, it met the first coastal canoes, a flotilla of four of different sizes. The largest had a bear's image carved into the bow and a man's image on the stern. The design so impressed Clark that he did a sketch of the craft. On the 6th, another flotilla came out from a village, bringing roots, trout, and furs for sale at bargain prices. Clark bought two beaver skins for five small fishhooks. The Indian said there was a white man living below with whom they traded. Encouraging news and a good day. But that night, the campground was scarcely sufficient. The men had to move large stones to make a place among the smaller stones where they could lie down on the level. All was wet and disagreeable. In the morning, fog. As it slowly lifted, the expedition set off. By mid-afternoon, the sky was clear. A shout went up. In his field notes, William Clark scribbled his immortal line, "Ocean in view!" Oh, the joy! The men dug in, putting everything they had into the race to the ocean. The canoes sped along. They made 34 miles that day. Once again, the campsite was barely sufficient to lie on and composed of small stones. It was raining. Despite the conditions, Clark wrote, "Great joy in camp. We are in view of the ocean, this great Pacific Ocean which we've been so long anxious to see." They could distinctly hear waves breaking on rocks. Without comment, but there must have been some pride in it, Clark added up the miles since the first falls, Solillo, 190 miles upriver. Then he wrote, "Ocean 4,142 miles from the mouth of Missouri River." There was no celebration. It was raining too hard for Crusot to bring out his violin. But in their ragged, all but rotten clothes and under their good-for-nothing covers, each man's heart must have been warm with satisfaction, each man's mind soaring with a sense of triumph. One longs for Lewis's emotional reaction to the triumph of crossing the continent. He had been at it for 2.5 years, ever since he left Washington, D.C. in the spring of 1803. One supposes that he shared that great joy in camp that Clark wrote of, but he never expressed it himself. He had not written in his journal since meeting the Nez Perce in September, and with minor exceptions would not again until the new year. For the biographer, Lewis's silence is a frustrating and tantalizing mystery. It was not that he didn't have time, for example. Every day he saw Clark writing in his journal, yet he did not lift his quill. Except for his severe illness when he first met the Nez Perce, Lewis had been active, coping successfully with the various challenges the party had to face. There is no hint in Clark's journal, or in the journals of the enlisted men, that he was depressed, downcast, muttering to himself, or otherwise showing symptoms of the melancholia Jefferson had observed in Lewis's father, and in Lewis when they lived together in the president's house. He was in a world filled with people, bays, weather, flora, and fauna all new to him, a situation that usually sent his quill flying over the pages, but he did not write. Was he depressed? Not so depressed as to neglect his duties, but enough to keep him from taking quill in hand to set down the day's events? If so, what caused the depression? With manic depressives, there is no agreement as to the cause of the disorder, whether biological or psychological, or what triggers either a manic or a depressed state. In many, if not most cases, a wave of euphoria, a surge of energy, and a feeling that I can do anything just comes on, followed by a wave of nausea, a draining of energy, and a feeling that I can't do anything. How long each state lasts depends on the individual. Weeks, months, years. In many cases, patients in a depressed state are almost incapable of acting. They have no energy, no sense of self-worth. They feel that nothing they do will matter to anyone. Lewis would come to such a point, but he certainly didn't feel that way in the fall of 1805. He knew the importance of what he was doing, and he had the willpower to summon up the energy to operate at peak efficiency. Jefferson later commented that he thought Lewis's voyage helped him ward off depression. There is nothing like daily decision-making to get the brain functioning and the body moving. From personal experience, Jefferson knew what he was talking about. But writing was another matter. Lewis couldn't summon the energy to be reflective. Of course, he had some real problems, of which the most distasteful was having to inform Jefferson that there was no all-water route or anything remotely like it across the continent, a fact reinforced by those terrible falls on the Columbia. Did the prospect of having to cross the Bitterroots again weigh on his mind? His worries were many. He feared that the expedition would not be able to rely on its rifles for subsistence until it got back to the Great Plains and the buffalo herds. He feared that the dwindling supply of trade goods was insufficient to purchase provisions in the quantity needed. Despite having reached the ocean, the expedition would not be a success unless and until the captains got their journals back to civilization. Was the triumph of reaching the ocean only a reminder of how much remained to be done and how little he had to do it with? Did he doubt that it could be done? It cannot be that he was simply too tired. He had too often demonstrated an ability to forget his aching muscles and his nearly overwhelming need to sleep in order to describe the day's activities and discoveries. It cannot be that he felt he had nothing to say beyond what Clark had written, for he often went on side explorations and saw what Clark did not. It cannot be that he regarded his journal as unimportant. He took too good care of it at all times for that to be the case. Yet he was a professional soldier, ignoring direct orders from his commander-in-chief. There must be an explanation, but we can only guess. My guess is that he was a manic depressive. The disorder ran in his family. If this is true, then it was his special triumph that he seldom let his emotional state take over, and then only momentarily. Whether he was high or low, his emotional state played no role in daily decision-making for 2.5 years. Whatever Lewis's emotional state, it was strongly affected by his drinking habits. It had been a long time since Meriwether Lewis had had a drink, and the certainty was that it would be a long time before he had another. He had been a hard-drinking youth. In St. Louis, during the winter of 1803-4, he attended a good many balls and private parties, where it seems likely he indulged in pretty heavy drinking. It went with the territory. Frontier officers and traders drank a lot of whiskey. For the first year of the expedition, Lewis had limited himself to the same ration of whiskey the men received, hardly enough to sustain a serious alcoholic, but enough to keep a habit, perhaps even a need, alive. On July 5, 1805, he had been forced to quit cold turkey. No one can say what, if any, effect Lewis's abstinence had on his mood. Whatever the reason, the scene that so moved Clark, who gave us such a memorable phrase as he let his emotions burst forth, was not described by Lewis. It is through Lewis's eyes and words that we see the White Cliffs, the Great Falls before the dams, the Gates of the Mountains, Three Forks, the Shoshones. Wonderful portraits all. Vivid, immediate, detailed. They set the standard. But we don't have his description of what he saw and how he felt in this moment of triumph. Clark had been a bit premature. What he had seen was the Columbian estuary, not the ocean. Actually, they were too close to the ocean for their own good anyway. For the next week and more, they were pinned down by the tide, the waves, the wind, at Point Ellis. They were unable to go forward, to retreat, to climb out of their campsite because of the overhanging rocks and hills, to do anything except endure pure misery. It rained for 11 days. At high tide, gigantic waterborne trees of cedar, fir, and spruce, some of them almost 200 feet long and up to 7 feet in diameter, crashed into the camp. Fires were hard to start, difficult to maintain. The captains and men of the expedition looked more like survivors from a shipwreck praying for rescue than the triumphant members of the Corps of Discovery. For a while, spirits remained high. For several days past, Clark wrote on the 9th, notwithstanding the disagreeable time of the party, they are all cheerful. But it didn't last. Never one to suffer silently, Clark wrote on November 12th, it would be distressing to a feeling person to see our situation at this time, all wet and cold with our bedding, etc., also wet, in a cove scarcely large enough to contain us, canoes at the mercy of the waves and driftwood, robes and leather clothes are rotten. November 22nd. The wind increased to a storm, blew with violence, throwing the water of the river with immense waves out of its banks, almost overwhelming us in water. Oh, how horrible is the day! November 27th. The wind blew with such violence that I expected every moment to see trees taken up by the roots. Some were. Oh, how tremendous is the day! Since May 1804, the expedition had stopped only for winter, or because the captains decided to take a couple of days' rest. They hated being immobilized by a force they could not fight. They had to be rescued by Clatsop Indians, the Chinookan people living on the south bank of the estuary, who were able to cross the estuary easily in their coastal canoes, in conditions that absolutely defeated every effort the Americans made to get out of their bad spot. The Clatsop saved them by selling roots and fish. On November 13th, the desperate captains sent Privates Coulter, Willard, and Shannon in the Indian canoe, which rode the swells better, to explore the shoreline beyond Point Ellis to see if a better campsite could be found. The next day, Coulter returned by land to report that there was a sandy beach in the bay beyond the point and away inland from it, and game in the area. The captains agreed that Lewis would lead an advance party to the site, while Clark arranged to move the entire camp as soon as the weather permitted. The following afternoon, Lewis took advantage of a head-on wind to have five men take himself, Driard, and three privates around the point. The paddlers put Lewis and his party ashore on the beach and returned to the main camp, their canoe nearly swamped by the following waves breaking over it. Finally, the impatient Lewis could do some exploring at the mouth of the river. He had a specific and immediate goal. He wanted to see if there really were some white men living on the coast. If so, and if he could find their trading post, he figured to be able to use Jefferson's letter of credit to provide the expedition with ample trading goods for the return trip, and start a copy of the journals to Washington via a visiting sea captain. And, of course, he wanted to see the ocean. When he set out in the morning, he found Privates Shannon and Willard in a precarious position. After separating from Coulter, they had gone hunting and exploring. They had spent the night with five Chinooks, members of the tribe living on the north bank. While they slept, the Indians stole their rifles. In the morning, discovering the theft, they informed the Indians with crude but emphatic signs that a larger party of white men was about to join them and would surely shoot the thieves. At that moment, Lewis and his small party appeared on the scene. His presence, and perhaps some threatening motions, convinced the thieves to repent. They handed back the rifles. Lewis sent Shannon back to the sandy beach, which he correctly surmised Clark would have reached by now. The chastised Indians went with Shannon, virtual prisoners. When Clark heard Shannon's story, he exploded. "I told these Indians they should not come near us, and if any one of their nation stole anything from us, I would have him shot," which they understood very well. "And if any of their women or bad boys took anything, to return it immediately and chastise them for it." Lewis, meanwhile, continued his exploration, rounding Cape Disappointment and going up the coastline for several miles. No trading post, no ship. He kept no journal. But he did carve his name into a tree at the extremity of Cape Disappointment with a certain sense of pride. Enough, anyway, to tell Captain Clark later that he had recorded his presence. At 1:30 p.m. on November 17th, Lewis joined Clark at the camp on the sandy beach that the party would occupy for the next week, in present-day Fort Canby State Park, near Mackenzie Head. It was a much superior campsite, and the hunters could get out and bring in some meat. On November 18th, it was Clark's turn to ramble. He set out with York and 10 men on a reconnaissance to Cape Disappointment, where he found Lewis's name carved in the tree. Together with the men, Clark followed Lewis's example, but greatly improved on it by adding to his name and the date the magnificent line, by land from the United States in 1804 and 1805. On his return from his reconnaissance, Clark found Lewis with a group of Chinooks, including two chiefs. They all sat for a smoke. The captains handed medals and an American flag to the chiefs. Some trading was done. One of the chiefs had on a robe made of sea otter skins that Clark declared, "more beautiful than any fur I had ever seen." Lewis agreed. In his turn, each captain tried to strike a bargain for the robe, offering different articles. "No," said the chief. He pointed at Sacagawea's belt of blue beads, the most highly prized beads of all. The captains looked at her questioningly. She made it clear that if she had to turn over the belt, she wanted something in return. One of the captains brought her a coat of blue cloth, and she handed over the belt. Clark's journal fails to say who ended up with the fur coat, but it surely wasn't Sacagawea. The next day, an old Chinook woman appeared with six of her daughters and nieces in tow. She was selling their favors. Clark remarked, "Those people appear to view sensuality as a necessary evil. The young females are fond of the attention of our men." At this, their westernmost campsite, the captains again felt the urge to mark their presence. Lewis used his branding iron to mark a tree. Clark and all the men carved their names into the surrounding trees. Meanwhile, the word had gotten out among the Clatsops that the captains would pay almost any price for sea otter furs. That night, a group came over the estuary with two robes to sell. The captains wanted them, but the price was too high. Clark was astonished when one owner turned down the offer of a watch, a handkerchief, a bunch of red beads, and a dollar in American coin. The Indians wanted blue beads, and the captains were all but out of them. Still, the captains found they liked the Clatsops much better than their relatives, the Chinooks, mainly because the Clatsops were not thieves. That became a factor in the decision that now had to be made: where to spend the winter. The obvious requirements were good water, plenty of game, and some shelter. They had three choices: to stay where they were, to cross to the south bank to see if there was a better site there, or to go back upstream to the falls. The Clatsops informed them that elk were plentiful on the south side. The captains were certain that their supply of beads and trinkets was so inadequate, and the Chinook's prices were so high, that they could not get through the winter buying their food. They needed a continuing source of meat. Lewis said that upriver the winter would be more severe, and this location would not really help them get started on the homeward voyage. They would have to wait for the snow to melt in the Bitterroots anyway, so there was plenty of time to go back up the Columbia Snake in the spring. He wanted to get closer to the ocean, which was easier done on the south side, so that he could put men to making salt from the seawater. He and all the men craved salt. Not Clark. He heartily disapproved, writing that he was indifferent to whether or not he had salt. Anyway, "salt water I view as an evil inasmuch as it is not healthy." Lewis had a better reason than his taste buds for wanting to stay near the coast. There was at least a good chance that a trading vessel would arrive during the winter. If one did, it would solve major supply problems. Clark agreed. He also pointed out that with elk more abundant on the south shore and deer on the north, the choice was easy. Elk were bigger and easier to kill, and their skins were better for clothing. So the captains made up their own minds, but on this occasion they decided to let everyone participate in the decision. They put it to a vote. They never explained why. Perhaps they felt that since they were all going to be in this together, they should all have a say. Maybe they just wanted to involve everyone so that none would have a right to complain. The choices were to stay, to proceed to the falls, or to cross to and examine the other side before deciding. Naturally, the third alternative won, overwhelmingly. Only Private John Shields voted against it. If the sites on the south side were unsatisfactory, about half the voters wanted to go up to the falls, half to stay at the mouth. York's vote was counted and recorded. Using Sacagawea's nickname, Clark noted, "Janie in favor of a place where there is plenty of potas." Apparently, she meant roots. This was the first vote ever held in the Pacific Northwest. It was the first time in American history that a black slave had voted, the first time a woman had voted. On November 26, after going upriver for 2 days to find a shorter crossing, the party crossed to the south shore. They camped on the east bank of the John Day River and were again pinned down by bad weather. By the 29th, Lewis had had enough. He told Clark he would take their Indian canoe and Round Tongue Point to examine the country where the Clatsop said there were elk. He handpicked the men he wanted with him. Driar, of course, along with Privates Reuben Field, Shannon, Coulter, and Labiche. They set out early in the morning, got around the point, and made camp that night near the site of present-day Astoria, Oregon. Lewis sent out the hunters. They returned with 4 deer and some geese and ducks, a haul as encouraging as it was welcome. Lewis made a short journal entry, providing a bare outline of his activities, as he would do the next 2 days as well. Clark wrote on the last page of Lewis's writings, "Captain Lewis Ruff notes when he left Captain Clark near the mouth of Columbia for a few days to examine the southwest side." Lewis set out at sunrise to explore Young's Bay, so named by Lieutenant Broughton of Vancouver's expedition. Finding nothing satisfactory at the outlet of Young's River, he went up today's Lewis and Clark River about a mile and was discouraged. Lewis returned to the bay, hoping to find some Clatsops, who have tantalized us with there being much game in their neighborhood, to ask them where that game was. All about him, they might have answered. There were great numbers of brants, geese, sandhill cranes, and blue herons, and a large variety and immense number of ducks in the bay. But, of course, Lewis wanted elk. In his field notes that night, he recorded botanical data. Over the next couple of days, he explored, this time going farther up the Lewis and Clark River, where he found his spot. He told Clark it was on a small bluff rising some 30 feet higher than the high tide mark, some 200 feet back from the river and about 3 miles up from its mouth. It was near a spring, and there were plenty of big trees that could be used to make shelter and a fort. It was but a few miles to the open ocean where salt could be made. Best of all, it promised good hunting. Driar and another hunter had killed 6 elk and 5 deer. Clark reported that this was very satisfactory information to all the party. The expedition made ready to move to its winter quarters as soon as the wind would allow it to round the point to get into the bay and then up the river. On December 6, the wind was too high, but the following morning Lewis guided the expedition to the site of what the captains would call Fort Clatsop. Clark took one look and pronounced it a most eligible situation. Chapter 25. Fort Clatsop, December 8, 1805 to March 23, 1806. On the morning of December 8, Clark set out to find the best route to the ocean and to find a place for a salt-making camp. Lewis sent out the hunters and put the remainder of the party to work cutting down trees, probably grand fir, to make huts and a palisade. When Clark returned from a successful reconnaissance 3 days later, Lewis was still cutting trees. Not until December 14th did he have enough for the men to start splitting logs. They found that the wood split beautifully, even to the width of 2 feet and more. The first hut they commenced building was a smokehouse. They were finding that the preservation of meat in that rainy climate required extraordinary measures. The work went slowly. It always rained, sometimes worse than others. On December 16th, Clark recorded, "The wind's violent, trees falling in every direction, whirlwinds with gusts of rain, hail, and thunder. This kind of weather lasted all day. Certainly one of the worst days that ever was." Many of the men were sick or injured. Some had tumors. Private William Werner had a strained knee. Private Joseph Field had biles. Private George Gibson had dysentery. Sergeant Nathaniel Pryor had a dislocated shoulder. York suffered from colic and griping. And the fleas, picked up from the Indians and inescapable, tormented their nights and prevented a sound sleep. Entertaining and trading with visiting Indians took time. On December 12th, the chief of a neighboring Clatsop village named Cobaway paid a visit. The Indians gave him the usual medal and traded for roots. Lewis purchased 2 lynx skins, Clark 2 otter skins. Prices were reasonable one day, outrageous the next. On December 23rd, Clark purchased a panther skin nearly 8 feet long for 6 small fishhooks, a worn-out file, and some spoiled fish. The next day, a young chief named Cascala came with his brother and 2 women. They wanted to sell a parcel of roots but demanded 2 files for them, which the captains decided was too high a price. Koskala then offered a woman to each captain, which we also declined accepting, Clark wrote, which also displeased them. The female part appeared to be highly disgusted at our refusing of their favors, etc. Despite the daily interruptions, the work went forward. By December 17th, enough of the walls of the huts were up so some of the men could begin filling the chinks between the logs. A week later, they were putting on the roofs. The captains moved into their unfinished hut on December 23rd. The next day, Private Joseph Field made writing tables for them, and the men moved into their as-yet unroofed huts. Fort Clatsop was about 50 feet square. It had 2 long, facing structures joined on the sides by palisaded walls. There was a main gate at the front and a smaller one at the rear that provided easy access to a spring some 30 yards distant. Between the buildings there was a parade ground about 50 feet by 20 feet. One of the structures was divided into 3 rooms or huts, which served as enlisted men's quarters. The other contained 4 rooms, one for the captains, one for Charbonneau, Sacajawea, and their son Jean-Baptiste, one to serve as an orderly room, and the 4th the smokehouse. At first light on Christmas morning, 1805, the men woke the captains with a volley, a shout, and a song. They exchanged presents. Private Whitehouse gave Captain Clark a pair of moccasins he had made, Private Silas Goodrich gave him a woven basket, Sacajawea gave him 2 dozen white weasel tails, and Captain Lewis gave him a vest, drawers, and socks. The captains divided the small quantity of tobacco they had left, keeping one part for use with the Indians and dividing the other among the men who smoked. The 8 non-smokers each got a handkerchief. The celebration didn't last long. It was a wet and disagreeable day, and as Clark recorded, "We would have spent this day, the Nativity of Christ, in feasting, had we anything either to raise our spirits or even gratify our appetites. Our dinner consisted of poor elk, so much spoiled that we ate it through mere necessity, some spoiled pounded fish and a few roots." 3 days later, the captains decided they could spare a small party of salt makers. The party left for the camp just south of present-day Seaside, Oregon, and went to work. On December 29th, the Clatsops informed the captains that a whale had foundered on the coast near Tillamook Head. Lewis at once determined to go there by water to get some oil and blubber. He prepared a party to take the canoes to fetch it, but for the next week the wind was too high to risk setting out. On December 30th, the fort was completed. At sunset, the captains told the Clatsops that from now on, when darkness fell, the gates would be shut and they must all get out of the fort. "Those people who are very forward and disagreeable," Clark reported, "left the huts with reluctance." But on New Year's Eve, he was happy to record that the Indians were much better behaved. "The sight of our sentinel who walks on his post has made this reform in those people who but yesterday was very impertinent and disagreeable to all." At dawn on New Year's Day, 1806, the men woke the captains with a volley and shouts of, "Happy New Year!" There was no other celebration and no feast. Lewis wrote that, "We were content with eating our boiled elk and wapato roots and solacing our thirst with our only beverage, pure water." During the more than 3 weeks the party had been building Fort Clatsop, Lewis wrote but 2 field notes, describing in some detail Steller's Jay. But on January 1st, he resumed making daily entries in his journal. He opened with a complaint that the volley fired by the men to usher in the new year was the only mark of respect which we had it in our power to pay this celebrated day. Our repast of this day was no better than that of Christmas. But after the first sentence, he wrote with a zest that seemed to indicate that a great weight had been lifted from him. It was 1806. He would be home this year. A year wasn't such a long time. Evidently, not until he began writing about getting home did Lewis realize how much he missed civilization. He had spent 1801-3 living with Thomas Jefferson in the president's house. His daily conversational fare had ranged from practical politics to the nature of man, from zoology to botany, geography to medicine, literature to history, all in the company of the leading cultural, intellectual, scientific, and political figures in the United States, and not a few from Europe. For 2 years he had danced to the best music, dined at the finest table, drunk the choicest wine. He had spent 1804-5 on the frontier and beyond. His daily conversational fare had been about immediate practical problems, mostly with enlisted men who had little, if any, formal education. With Clark, he could discuss scientific matters, natural history, geography, and other subjects, but Clark was more a Kentuckian than a Virginian, more a frontier soldier than a polished member of the president's staff. Even with Clark, the flow of the talk had its limits. Now, with the coming of the new year, Lewis could dream of returning to Washington, Charlottesville, Philadelphia, civilization. The thought released him from his lethargy. He wrote with enthusiasm about how much he anticipated the first day of January 1807, when in the bosom of our friends we hope to participate in the mirth and hilarity of the day. We shall completely, both mentally and corporally, enjoy the repast which the hand of civilization has prepared for us. The anticipation was made all the keener by the thought that he would be able to draw on the recollection of the present to be the center of attention, telling around the table the story of the crossing of the continent. It was a prospect delicious to dream about. So on January 1st, 1806, with winter quarters completed, his face and his mind turned east. But first he had to get through the winter. After recording that the men had given him and Clark fresh elk marrow bone and tongue for a New Year's dinner, and noting his worry about two missing enlisted men who had apparently lost their way returning from the salt-making site, and with the fortification completed, he wrote out a detailed order for the more exact and uniform discipline and government of the garrison. The order was precise. It was based on principles established at U.S. Army frontier fortifications over the past 30 years, principles that had been learned by the experience of living as a platoon-sized party in the midst of potentially hostile Indians. First, as was habitual with the expedition, there would be a sergeant of the guard and three privates always on duty in the orderly room. Second, the sentinel shall be posted both day and night on the parade ground in front of the commanding officer's quarters. If at any time the sentinel thought it necessary to go to any other part of the fort, in order the better to inform himself of the designs or approach of any party of savages, he is not only at liberty but is hereby required to do so. It was also his duty to inform the sergeant of the guard of the arrival of any party of Indians, and the sergeant's duty to report the same to the captains immediately. Lewis ordered the men to treat the natives in a friendly manner. Nor were they permitted at any time to abuse, assault, or strike them, unless the natives started to fight. The soldiers were allowed to put out of his room any native who may become troublesome to him. If the Indian refused to go or made trouble, the sergeant of the guard should take over. He was authorized to employ such coercive measures, not extending to the taking of life, as shall at his discretion be deemed necessary. If an Indian was caught stealing, the sergeant should immediately inform the captains, who would take it from there. In this, as elsewhere, Lewis made certain that the lines of authority and the decision-making power were absolutely fixed. All Indians were to be out of the fort at sunset, except those the captains might specially permit to spend the night. Both gates should be shut and secured overnight. The sergeant of the guard would keep the key to the meat house and see that regular fires burned as needed. He should visit the canoes each day to make sure they were safely secured. He should report to the captains in person upon being relieved. The huts had their own cooks, kettles, and fires. The captains furnished each mess with an axe to provide firewood. All other public tools deposited in the captain's quarters could only be taken with their permission and must be returned immediately after they were used. This was to prevent the men from falling into temptation and trading an awl or a file for sexual favors or furs. Lewis was explicit on the point. Any individual selling or disposing of any tool or iron or steel instrument, arms, accoutrements, or ammunition shall be deemed guilty of a breach of this order and shall be tried and punished accordingly. He exempted gunsmith John Shield from the restriction. Discipline, order, regularity, security, peace with the neighbors if at all possible. These were Lewis's goals, as they have been the goals of every company commander from the time of the Roman legions to today. No orders, however, can guard against all contingencies or accidents or just stupid actions. On the morning of January 11th, the sergeant of the guard reported that the Indian canoe was missing. Lewis made inquiry and discovered that the men who had used it the previous evening had been negligent in securing her, and the tide had carried her off. He sent two parties out to search for her, but they came up empty-handed. So, too, the party he sent out the next morning. "We therefore give her over as lost," Lewis sadly recorded. Fortunately, on February 5th, Sergeant Gass took advantage of a high tide to explore an inlet and found the canoe, so long lost and much lamented. Routine wears down vigilance. The almost daily coming and going of the Clatsops, and sometimes the Chinooks, made an Indian presence inside the fort a familiar sight. More often than not, the captains gave a chief and a small mixed party permission to spend the night. The men had frequent sexual contact with Indian women. The young braves were mild and inoffensive, men who obviously preferred fishing and trading to fighting. Even the captains grew lax. On February 20th, Lewis caught himself up short. A Chinook chief and 25 braves paid a visit. Lewis gave the chief a smoke and a medal. At sunset, he told the Chinooks to leave. Evidently, they gave him some trouble about the order. They had come from across the estuary and would not be able to return home that night. Lewis insisted. Then he wrote a passage of justification that revealed his deeply rooted fears and suspicions of the Chinooks, indeed of all Indians. Whatever Jefferson's hopes for eventually incorporating the Indians into the body politic, Lewis obviously believed that there could be no living with the Indians until they had been civilized or cowed or brought into the American trading empire and thus made dependent on the government. "Notwithstanding their apparent friendly disposition," Lewis wrote, "their great avarice and hope of plunder might induce them to be treacherous. At all events, we determined always to be on our guard and never place ourselves at the mercy of any savages. We well know that the treachery of the aborigines of America and the too great confidence of our countrymen in their sincerity and friendship has caused the destruction of many hundreds of us." But despite the clear lesson of history, Lewis complained, as the men became accustomed to the visiting coastal Indians, "we find it difficult to impress on their minds the necessity of always being on their guard." Lewis believed that the well-known treachery of the natives by no means entitled them to such confidence, and caught himself up short with the realization that he too had become lax. So, he told himself, as for confidence in the peaceful intentions of the Indian visitors, "we must check its growth in our own minds, as well as those of our men, by recollecting ourselves and repeating to our men that our preservation depends on never losing sight of this trait, treachery, in their character, and always being prepared to meet it in whatever shape it may present itself." James Rhonda protests that Lewis was too extreme. He writes that Lewis's attitude, with its familiar themes of native treachery and brutality, was more suited to the Kentucky and Ohio frontier of the 1790s than to the coastal Indians of 1806. Perhaps so. And perhaps the captains could have done more to establish good relations with the Chinooks, as Rhonda suggests. But had Lewis heard such criticism, he could have replied, "We encouraged our suspicions, did security by the book, and had no trouble." As in many frontier fortifications, life at Fort Clatsop was almost unbearably dull. Unlike most frontier garrisons, the fort suffered only one minor breach of discipline. Partly this was because the garrison was so small, partly because the men had been through so much together and had so much more coming up, partly because they had no whiskey. No fistfights or similar troubles relieved the routine. "Nothing worthy of note today," Lewis wrote in his journal, day after day. With one or two exceptions, his entries recorded the comings and goings and successes or failures of the hunters, the health of the men, the diet, trading sessions with the Clatsops, more often than not unsuccessful, and nothing else. The weather was depressing at best. Fixing latitude and longitude exactly would have provided some diversion and a sense of accomplishment, but it couldn't be done. For the entire first month in the fort, Lewis was unable to make a single observation. "I am mortified," he wrote on February 25th, 1806, "at not having it in my power to make more celestial observations since we have been at Fort Clatsop, but such has been the state of the weather that I have found it utterly impracticable." The men had sex for diversion, but from all the evidence, the captains did not. The men paid the price for their activity, not only in beads or trinkets, but also by contracting venereal disease. Lewis was their doctor. "Goodrich has recovered from the Lewis veneri, syphilis, which he contracted from an amorous contact with a Chinook damsel," Lewis wrote on January 27th. "I cured him as I did Gibson last winter by the use of mercury." Lewis was an attentive doctor. When Private Gibson came down with a violent cold, so severe it incapacitated him, Lewis first listed the cause, the constant rain, wading through streams and marshes, always wet. Second, the patient's condition, nearly free from pain. Third, the patient's appearance, a good deal reduced and very languid. And fourth, the drug and physical therapy he prescribed. Broken doses of diluted nitre, saltpeter, and made him drink plentifully of sage tea, had his feet bathed in warm water, and at 9 p.m. gave him 35 drops of laudanum. At Fort Mandan, the men's health had been a minor problem. At Fort Clatsop, the men's health was a major worry. There was always someone down with a cold or a flu or a venereal disease attack or a strained muscle. On February 22nd, Lewis noted that there were 5 men in the sick bay, 17% of the total strength, and commented, "We have not had as many sick at any one time since we left Wood River. The general complaint seems to be bad colds and fevers, something, I believe, of the influenza." On March 20th, as the party was preparing to leave, Lewis noted, "Many of our men are still complaining of being unwell. They remain weak, principally, I believe, for the want of proper food." He rightly figured that, along with the diet, the weather was the cause. Unfortunately, there was nothing that Dr. Lewis could do for his patients to improve their food or the climate. For the Clatsops and Chinooks, neither the weather nor the diet had an adverse effect. To the contrary, they were thriving tribes before the smallpox hit them, still vibrant when Lewis and Clark came to spend the winter. With few enemies and fewer wars, they were rich, enjoying an abundance of fish and furs and first access to European trade goods. They loved the food and the climate, had perfectly adjusted to them, and rightly thought of the Pacific Northwest as a bountiful provider, almost paradise. To the captains and the men, it was a miserable place that they couldn't wait to get out of. Lewis expressed one major reason for that point of view. "I expect when we get under way, we shall be much more healthy. It has always had that effect on us heretofore." Fort Clatsop was almost more a prison than a fortification. The men not out hunting spent their days at hard labor, scraping at elk hides and making moccasins, 10 per man for the return trip, keeping the fire going in the smokehouse, difficult at best because the timber was wet and only smoldered instead of smoking properly, and carrying out other tasks that they regarded as women's work and resented or even hated. Lewis supervised the work. He made no recorded excursion from the fort. His boredom is evident in some of his journal entries. February 2nd. "Not any occurrence today worthy of notice, but all are pleased that 1 month of the time which binds us to Fort Clatsop and which separates us from our friends has now elapsed." March 3rd. "Everything moves on in the old way, and we are counting the days which separate us from the 1st of April, the scheduled departure date, and which bind us to Fort Clatsop." The food at Fort Clatsop contributed to the monotony. Getting enough of it was a daily worry for Lewis, getting some variety into the diet almost impossible. The expedition lived on elk. Over their more than 3 months on the coast, the hunters killed 131 elk, along with 20 deer, a few beaver and otter, and a raccoon. Driard was the most productive, sometimes killing a half dozen or more elk in a day. On January 12th, Lewis wrote that Driard had killed 7 elk that day and commented, "I scarcely know how we should subsist were it not for the exertions of this excellent hunter." Despite Driard's success, not enough game was coming in to feed the party. The captain supplemented the meat with dried fish and roots purchased from the Clatsops. It is odd that the captains, after their experience of doing so well fishing in the Missouri River, seldom, if ever, sent out fishermen. And apparently, despite the high prices charged by the Indians and the nearly spent supply of trade goods, no man, nor Sacagawea, ever went out to dig roots. Hunters sometimes brought back berries. Occasionally, the captains were able to purchase dogs. A good thing, too, Lewis believed. While we lived principally on the flesh of this animal, we were much more healthy, strong, and more fleshy than we had been since we left the buffalo country. Fortunately, the men were extremely fond of the dog meat. For my own part, Lewis commented, I have become so perfectly reconciled to the dog that I think it an agreeable food and would prefer it vastly to lean venison or elk. Within a day of Lewis's resumption of journal writing, Clark had established a practice of copying Lewis's journal verbatim. He continued that practice as long as Lewis kept writing. But on this entry of January 3rd, Clark made one change. As for my own part, he concluded the entry on dog meat, I have not become reconciled to the taste of this animal as yet. One of the captain's other differences of opinion also concerned food. On January 5th, the salt makers brought in a sample of their product. We found it excellent, fine, strong, and white, Lewis wrote. This was a great treat to myself and most of the party. I say most of the party, for my friend Captain Clark declares it to be a mere matter of indifference with him whether he uses it or not. For myself, I must confess, I felt a considerable inconvenience from the want of it. Clark copied the passage, then added as an explanation, I care but little about salt, having from habit become entirely careless about my diet. Lewis remarked that he didn't care what kind of meat he got, whether elk or dog or horse or wolf, so long as it was fat. I have learned to think, he wrote, that if the cord be sufficiently strong, which binds the soul and body together, it does not so much matter about the materials which compose it. The cord that bound body and soul together at Fort Clatsop was made of elk. At breakfast and supper, day after day, it was boiled elk, dried and jerked elk, leftover elk from the previous meal, more elk. When there was fresh elk that could be roasted, the men gorged themselves. But the meat was seldom fresh, because the hunters had to extend their range through the winter, and by mid-January the kills were taking place miles from the fort. Men had to go out to bring in the meat, which sometimes took days. There often wasn't enough meat at all. Because the men devoured the fresh meat so prodigiously, Lewis worried about a steady supply. He ordered that all the meat would hereafter be jerked, then was surprised when it turned out they ate the jerky at a prodigious rate also. On January 20th, there was only 3 days' supply on hand. But, he wrote, no one seems much concerned about the state of the stores, so much for habit. We have latterly so frequently had our stock of provisions reduced to a minimum and sometimes taken a small touch of fasting that 3 days' full allowance excites no concern. Anyway, Lewis wrote, our skill as hunters afford us some consolation, for if there is any game of any description in our neighborhood, we can track it up and kill it. Lewis tried to be charitable to elk. He noted on January 29th that he was enjoying the most perfect health on this food. And after all, it wasn't so bad. A keen appetite supplies in a great degree the want of more luxurious sauces or dishes, and still render my ordinary meals not uninteresting to me, for I find myself sometimes inquiring of the cook whether dinner or breakfast is ready. One welcome change in diet came on January 10th. 4 days earlier, Clark had set out in canoes with a party of 11 to find the whale that had washed ashore south of the salt camp. Lewis had proposed to lead a party himself earlier. Why Clark took over, Lewis doesn't say. Among the party was Sacagawea. In a charming passage, Lewis explained how she got to go along. The Indian woman was very importunate to be permitted to go, and was therefore indulged. She observed that she had traveled a long way with us to see the great waters, and that now that monstrous fish was also to be seen, she thought it very hard she could not be permitted to see either. When Clark returned, he brought back 300 pounds of blubber and a few gallons of rendered oil. He had hoped for much more, but the carcass had been stripped by the time he arrived, and he had to buy what he got from the natives. Despite Clark's disappointment, Lewis was more than satisfied. After eating, he felt so good he ventured a small joke. Small as the store is, he wrote, we prize it highly, and thank the hand of Providence for directing the whale to us, and think him much more kind to us than he was to Jonah, having sent this monster to be swallowed by us instead of swallowing of us, as Jonah's did. But soon the whale, blubber, and oil were gone. It was back to elk. Lewis wrote on February 7th, "This evening we had what I call an excellent supper. It consisted of a marrow bone apiece and a brisket of boiled elk that had the appearance of a little fat on it. This, for Fort Clatsop, is living in high style." Toward the end of February, the Yucalan, or candlefish, began to run in immense numbers. The Clatsops netted them and sold them to the expedition, after showing them how to prepare the fish, which Lewis called anchovy. Each Yucalan was about 7 inches long. The Clatsop method was to string them together on a wooden spit and roast them. "They are so fat," Lewis found, "they require no additional sauce, and I think them superior to any fish I ever tasted." From then until they left, the captains bought all the Yucalan they could afford. Supervising the men's work and trading with the Indians took up only a part of Lewis's time. He spent much of each day at his desk in his damp, chilly, smoky quarters, with only a candle for illumination, writing in his journal. It was an almost monk-like existence, but he thrived on scholarship, and most of what he wrote was scientific. The subjects were botany, zoology, geography, and ethnology. Lewis's great outpouring during the Fort Clatsop winter constituted an invaluable contribution to knowledge. Botany was the subject he wrote the most about, partly because of the astonishing growth of trees and plants on the Northwest Pacific coast, partly because it was Jefferson's favorite scientific study. Jefferson considered Lewis a better zoologist than botanist. Lewis agreed with that judgment. On February 4th, 1806, writing about the fir trees in the vicinity of Fort Clatsop, he apologized by saying, "I shall describe them as well as my slender botanical skill will enable me." But he was skillful enough in both fields to provide descriptions of dozens of previously unknown plants and